Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and Rinola House Museum of American Art presents the exhibition Things Wondrous and Humble, American Still Life, through December 8th in the Mary and Charlie Babcock Wing Gallery. Things Wondrous features some of the finest examples of still life, both traditional and some unexpected approaches, from collections all across North Carolina. I recently met with Rinola House curator Allison Slaby at the museum for a delightful guided tour.
Still life, something familiar to many of us in the art world, still life paintings, certainly. How far back does it go? When did it begin?
Well, it really has a long tradition in the history of art, from wall paintings in Roman villas up to and through the Renaissance. And in the Renaissance, still life was usually part of a larger scene, usually a religious scene. And then the height of its popularity was really 17th century Holland, when you had this emerging middle class, and they were demanding pictures with engaging but accessible subjects that they could really use to decorate their homes. And, you know, still life is kind of the poor stepchild in the world of art history. It's on the hierarchy of art, it's the lowest rung on that ladder. It starts with pictures of heroic and noble deeds and religious art, and then steps down to portraiture and landscape, and then you've got still life at the very bottom. But it's always been very popular because it is accessible, and it also has this amazing kind of illusionistic aesthetic that viewers find really engaging. And then there are the hidden symbols, which you can kind of decode, and it gives you a whole other context for the meaning of the painting. So that's one of the reasons that we were attracted to this topic.
And what sorts of symbols were really common early on in the tradition?
Well, this tradition of using objects to communicate an idea is something that gets really solidified in 17th century Holland, when a flower, it's beautiful to look at, but it also symbolizes the brevity of life, because flowers fade and they droop. A candle, a burning candle, or a candle that's just been snuffed out, also symbolizes the brevity of life, because it can be snuffed out. There was a lot about the brevity of life, because life was brief in those days, quite honestly. A mirror might symbolize earthly vanity. Books, earthly knowledge. A flute or other musical instruments might symbolize sensual pleasure, because it's a visual reminder of your other senses, so the pleasure of listening to music. So when you study the art of 17th century Holland, you kind of become accustomed to, oh, I think that, you know, this candle is symbolizing that life is transient.
Things wondrous and humble. Could you speak to the wondrous nature of still life?
There are these incredible, beautiful explosion, profusions of fruits and flowers, which again have this hidden meaning of fruit can rot and flowers can fade. He was painting right after the Civil War, when people were very conscious of the loss of life. But in his wonderful painting of flowers, there's a little bird's nest with eggs at the bottom, and that reminds us of new life and hope for new life after the Civil War. And it, you know, it's not just the 19th century. We have amazing paintings by Audrey Flack and Ben Shonsight from the 1970s, which are also this kind of explosion of things and stuff, but done kind of tongue-in-cheek sense of humor about our current interest in materialism and consumerism. So they're very aware in the 20th century, when they're painting these kind of over-the-top profusions of things, that we do have complicated relationships with our possessions.
So much effort goes into curating these exhibits, and I know that the placement of every painting is considered and debated and worked through. What are you hoping the takeaway is from folks who'll be coming to see this exhibit?
That there is hidden meaning in every work of art that they'll see. That it may appear to be a simple arrangement of objects, but it could be the artist challenging himself with new forms or new styles, or trying to communicate an idea, or in some cases, constructing his own identity on the canvas. There's a wonderful still life by Gregory Gillespie, which includes a lot of masks, which I think was really about him concealing his own inner demons and some of the struggles that he was experiencing at the time. So there are numerous, just incredible stories to tell with these paintings. And I think that they're accessible because we all have things in our lives. We have stuff that we own that help to construct our own identities. So I think that there are just wonderful stories to tell with these paintings.
All right. Well, let's see both The Wondrous and The Humble downstairs. We're going to get ready for a gallery tour here at Rinalda House. And we're walking down the hallway on the way to the Babcock Wing through Rinalda House into the lovely lobby. The gallery is closed, but we get a sneak peek. And wow, this just really hits you when you walk in the door. Allison, tell me about this painting that greets us as we walk into the gallery.
The first painting that you see is Audrey Flack's Bounty from 1978, and it's this incredible pastiche of stuff. There's a burning candle, which of course references the brevity of life. There's a handheld mirror, which references vanity. So there are these clever art historical references, but then she combines them with this very kitschy plastic parrot and plastic grapes and carrots and cherries and a lemon that seems to just kind of float towards you. And all of these kind of strange, kitschy elements. But then at the bottom, there's a photograph of her daughter. So it's items that seem meaningless, items that are meaningful, items that are personally meaningful to her. I think ultimately it is about all of the stuff that makes up our lives.
There's a really dreamy quality about that, and the three-dimensionality of it is striking. Is there a particular style that you'd use to describe this?
This would be called photorealism. She was part of the photorealist movement, and she used an airbrush with acrylic paint to produce this very smooth day glow surface. But interestingly, she then highlights the surface with these big blobs of white paint to pick up the kind of shininess of the plastic parrot. So you do see the hand of the artist as well.
Very contemporary looking, and yet painted in 1978. Bounty. Okay.
Let's head into Things Wondrous and Humble.
All right, here we go.
So this is our painting by Severin Rosen from Rinalda's collection, and most of the works in the exhibition are from our collection. And this is painted in about 1867, just after the Civil War. And it's just a profusion of flowers, all kinds of different flowers. It's really kind of a fantasy. These flowers couldn't all have been in bloom at the same time. So he's really creating this kind of ideal composition. And it is about kind of hope and optimism after the Civil War for new life. And he really brings that message home at the bottom with this little bird's nest that has three eggs in it. And the eggs really are about new life.
Beyond the symbolism, it's a beautiful work of art. The detail is incredible, and the variety of colors is just wonderful. Down to the tassels on the fabric on top of the table there. How was he known in his time? Was he revered or just another painter? Where did he fall in that spectrum?
Unfortunately, Rosen did have some struggles. He lived in Pennsylvania, and he was fond of beer and often paid his bar tab with paintings. So, so he is much more revered now than he was in the 19th century.
For those who go to the website and find out more about Things Wondrous and Humble, they'll recognize this painting.
This is by William Michael Harnett. It's called Job Lot Cheap, and I think we're definitely more on the humble end of the scale with this painting of really just a jumble of books placed on top of a crate. And this is what you would see maybe in a bookseller's shop. He's placed together this jumble of unrelated titles, and he's going to sell them cheaply. He's actually used the cover of a book to write a sign that he's going to sell this job lot, this jumble of unrelated titles, cheaply. And the reason that he needs to sell them cheaply is because the crate that they're resting on has a lot of just published books. So he's got to make space on his shelves for new books, and he's getting rid of these old unsold titles. But I really think that this painting is about the permanence of art, the permanence of the written word. They might be sold, but they'll continue to exist. And by extension, the permanence of Harnett's own painting, that it will continue to exist even as it changes hands.
I love the layout. It breathes so nicely. I feel like I can go one-on-one with all these paintings. Nicely laid out.
We really worked hard to select the best still lifes from our collection, but also from some really key collections across the state, the North Carolina Museum, the Weatherspoon, the Ackland, and really bring some treasures that enliven our own collection because we get to compare them to works from other collections as well.
Now, from the hyperrealism, this looks almost impressionistic.
Exactly. I think that you would call this still life adapted in an impressionist style. We are very lucky to have this painting from the Weatherspoon by John Singer Sargent, one of the masters of late 19th century, early 20th century painting. And he didn't often paint still lifes. He usually painted portraits, society portraits. But this is probably a little sketch that he did just in his own time, relaxing, sitting in a garden, a beautiful little, I think, Japanese-inspired painting of a vase with some blossoms in it and a very sketchily painted background. And it's just a very relaxed mode for Sargent.
I love the contrast here, but they all work together so well somehow. And this is quite a contrast.
So in the exhibition, we have, I would say, three rather traditional fruit still lifes. And then you come to the next painting in the series, which is by Julie Heffernan from 1996. And it appears to be a traditional fruit still life until you realize that embedded in the individual pieces of fruit, there are these strange, surreal, somewhat disturbing scenes. There's a scene that looks like there are some kind of otherworldly figures fighting. There's a scene that looks like an almost film noir interrogation. And it's just a really intriguing, I would say, postmodern work of art. And Julie Heffernan is actually coming to speak on November 21st. And so I'm hoping that she'll clue us in as to the inspiration for this piece.
How do you find out about the inner workings of these paintings?
Well, in the case of this painting by Robert Gwathmey called Bell from 1965, we're fortunate to have the writings of the artist. So we do know what he was attempting to communicate with this work. It's a very complex image, multiple figures, multiple objects. I think one of the most recognizable, of course, is the cross that's held by the man on the right. But what's interesting about that figure is that he's holding two crosses, one in front of him and one behind him, which is in flames. And I think it's about hypocrisy, racism, and racist violence in the 1960s.
And are docents on hand to answer questions for this exhibit?
Docents will be giving tours from time to time. There are wonderful object labels written by our guest curator for this exhibition, Martha Severins, and they will clue you into the meaning of the objects.
And this is a feast for the eyes as well. And is this part of your collection? I've seen this before.
This is a painting by Gregory Gillespie called Studio Still Life from 1978, and it is part of our collection. I think it's an incredible work. Large scale, it's a still life, but also a self-portrait, the artist painting himself. And I think one of the intriguing things about the painting is there's a lot of sexual imagery. There are several masks in the painting, which I think communicate the idea of deceit, that he's concealing something, that he's probably concealing his own demons. He was a very troubled man.
I love the texture of the wallpaper. I mean, you feel like, again, you could just reach out and touch it. Is it raised such that there is actually a texture to it?
There is, but it's all paint.
Yeah, and I know there's some three-dimensional works in the exhibit as well, but that's about as close as you can get to three-dimensional art within this realm.
Exactly. There are some wonderful three-dimensional pieces that we'll take a look at around the corner.
We're on our way.
This piece by Elihu Vedder called Dancing Girl from 1871 is one of the works that we're using to challenge our visitors. What is a still life? Because you would look at this piece and think it's a portrait or a genre painting because it depicts a dancing girl. But the objects in the painting really tell the story. She's an entertainer. She has juggling balls and juggling sticks and a tambourine. And she can also tell your fortune. And it's the Wheel of Fortune down in the corner with the arrow pointing at the skull that communicates to the viewer that youth and beauty are fleeting, both for the dancing girl and for the viewer himself.
Some of these are very large panels. This is another large work, another feast for the eyes.
Yes, this piece from our collection by Ben Schonseit called English Town Jewels. Schonseit was another photorealist artist like Audrey Flack. He used photographs to create his paintings. So this is a huge painting of jewelry. And so you're trying to figure out what's it about. And the title is English Town Jewels, and it's referencing a flea market that he visited in New Jersey in 1971. So what appears to be precious at first is actually kind of worthless and junky.
When you say the use of a photograph, that tradition goes way back, using technology to enhance the process.
Right, back to the use of the camera obscura in the 17th century. And what's remarkable, I think, about this painting is that it does look like a photograph, but it is a painting. He uses the photograph to create the painting, but then he creates these tiny little brushstrokes using an airbrush and using acrylic paint, and it's so hyper-realist, it's absolutely dazzling.
And yet he takes it slightly out of focus. Interesting technique there.
Schonseit has a visual impairment, actually, which means that many of his works have a kind of out-of-focus, blurry quality to them.
How about that? All right. There is some whimsy here in the Babcock Wing.
There's a lot of whimsy. I think there are moments of great humor in this exhibition. With this piece, which is called Telephone from 2000 by Robert Lazzarini, which we borrowed from our friends at Wake Forest, the question that we're asking is when the object is an object and not an image of an object, is it a still life? So again, we're challenging our visitors. So this piece is, I think you would call it a sculpture, but it was produced in this absolutely fascinating way. He took a photograph of a kind of 1970s era avocado-colored telephone rotary dial, and then he scanned it, put it in his computer, and then distorted it digitally and used the distorted image to create this object out of plastic and rubber and metal and paper. And so it looks like a telephone that you've stretched out, and then it's mounted on the wall, and it's just, it's a lot of fun.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for this gallery tour.
Thanks, David. We're really looking forward to welcoming people here this fall.
Rinalda House curator Allison Slaby, Things Wondrous and Humble, American Still Life, continues through December. American Arts Discovery begins Tuesday, September 3rd at Rinalda, and continues Tuesdays and Thursdays through October 10th, from 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. The 12-session course uses an interdisciplinary approach to teach American art history through the museum's art collection and researching correlations in literature and music of the same time period. Cinema Under the Stars kicks off at Rinalda on Friday, August 30th at 9 p.m. with Back to the Future. You'll find links to all of this summer's screenings at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a short break right now. When we get back, get set for some kind of fun. It's Open Dream Ensemble, with four dancer, musician, playwright, actor, director types who all called UNC School of the Arts home at one point in their lives, and they're back wearing big shoes next after this short break.